We wanted to build communities of action because our in our country, institutions are endemic. They're endemic corruption, and the institutions are weak. So what we wanted to do was stop waiting for government and help build communities bottom up using technology. Hmm. That dream is still there. We succeeded at it for up until 2016.
And how do you protect yourself?
Experience from the past helps, right? But now what we've done is the first new threat is actually the psychological threat, the attacks against our reporters, the people on the front line on social media. You have to deal with that, and it's something that is completely new. So we send our social media team, our reporters on the front lines, to counseling. But then the counselors also need to learn how to do that. So we helped bring in the DART Center to help the trainers, right?
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue our discussion and post online at democracynow.org. Maria Ressa, founder, CEO, executive editor of Rappler, leading independent news website in the Philippines. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to KBOO.FM/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
Yo. KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, FBI classifies Proud Boys as an extremist group, the Me Too rally, and in international news, Guatemalan volcano eruption. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 19th, 2018. I'm Rachel Hartley.
And I'm Ken Jones. A very small number of the alt-right group Patriot Prayer gathered in downtown Portland on Saturday to protest the Me Too movement. The so-called Him Too event was countered by hundreds of survivors of sexual abuse and their supporters who stood together to say enough is enough and that survivors must be honored and believed rather than mocked and dismissed. Nearly 100 Portland police and federal officers dressed in riot gear were there to separate the two groups and offer protection to the outnumbered and overwhelmed Patriot Prayer contingent. The Patriot Prayer demonstrators were joined by several members of the Proud Boys, who have been classified by the FBI as an extremist group with ties to white nationalism, according to a report in The Guardian. The report was based on a document produced by Washington State law enforcement. The FBI's designation had not previously been made public. The document goes on to say the FBI had warned local law enforcement agencies that the Proud Boys are actively recruiting in the Pacific Northwest and that Proud Boy members have contributed to the recent escalation of violence at rallies held on college campuses and in cities like Charlottesville, Portland, and Seattle. The document was provided to The Guardian by the government transparency nonprofit Property of the People. It was part of an internal affairs investigation into a probationary deputy in the Clark County Sheriff's Department. The Clark County deputy, Erin Willey, was fired last July after a photo of her wearing a Proud Boys Girls sweatshirt was published by the Columbia newspaper. Proud Boys Girls is the female auxiliary of the Proud Boys group. In addition to the FBI designation as extremists and white nationalists, the Proud Boys are listed as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. In Clark County, the Proud Boys have been integral to the Patriot Prayer Movement, which organizes alt-right rallies such as the Hymn 2 event in Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, and other Pacific Northwest cities.
The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, a group of California crab fishermen, is suing 30 fossil fuel companies for damages the crab industry has suffered as a result of climate change. Noah Oppenham, the executive director for the group, told the Guardian newspaper, quote, "We're taking a stand for the captains and crew, their families and the business owners that support the fleet, the fossil fuel companies named in our lawsuit knowingly caused harm, and they need to be held accountable." The court filing says, in part, and quote, "Defendants have known for nearly 50 years that greenhouse gas pollution from their fossil fuel products have a significant impact on Earth's climate, including a warming of the oceans. Defendants concealed the dangers, sought to undermine public support for greenhouse gas regulation, and engaged in massive campaigns to promote the ever-increasing use of their products at ever greater volumes." The suit follows the filing of Juliana versus the U.S., in which a group of the school children seek redress for their future suffering under oil industry caused climate change. Ann Aiken, the U.S. District Court judge overseeing the Juliana case in Oregon, said in 2016, and quote, "Exercising my reasoned judgment, I have no doubt that the right to claim a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society." Aiken also said, and quote, "Even when a case implicates halty, contested political issues, the judiciary must not shrink from its role as a co-equal or co-equal branch of government. But it seems likely that the Supreme Court will do just that, as it has repeatedly displayed and delayed access to the courts." The crab fishermen's suit also joins cities such as New York and San Francisco in seeking direct reparations for damages and anticipated damages from human-induced global warming.
Terry Bowles Atherton was elected president of the Portland Rose Festival Foundation at the annual board meeting on October 25th. Bowles Atherton, who currently serves as director of physician development and provider compensation for Providence Medical Group, first volunteered 10 years ago when she signed up to be wardrobe coordinator and chaperone for the Rose Festival Court. In 2009, she was invited to join the board. Bowles Atherton is a second-generation Oregonian and daughter of Gail Black Bowles and Carl Bowles. She's a Thanksgiving baby born in Emmanuel Hospital and raised in Northeast Portland, where she attended Alameda Elementary School, Beaumont Middle School, and later St. Mary's Academy. Bowles Atherton completed her Bachelor of Science degree at Vanderbilt University and returned to Portland, where she met and married Jermaine Atherton. Like many Portlanders, Bowles Atherton's family has a history with the Rose Festival, dating back to the 1960s when her uncle, Jimmy Bang Bang Walker, entered the first Grand Floral Parade float representing the African-American albino community.
Saturday afternoon, Joy Gibson's right-wing militia once again descended on downtown Portland, this time wearing a mask of concern for men facing accusations from the, end quote, Me Too movement. But Me Too was there first, and in greater numbers, as popular mobilization gave voice to survivors of gender violence, KBOO's Teresa Mitchell reports.
The Hymn 2 rally put out by Patriot Prayer was not the only rally downtown. It was preceded by a rally by Popular Mobilization. The first speaker is Kat of Pop Mob. She is followed by Olivia of the Democratic Socialists of America.
All right, everybody, welcome. Welcome today to Survivors Are Everywhere, a survivor shout-out. Put your hands together for everyone who's here right now. We are so excited to have everybody showing up today to stand together in power as a community against the fascist misogyny that's going to take place later today, and to stand in support of everybody who has had the courage, strength, and resiliency to survive the trauma that they've experienced and that has brought them to this place now, or wherever you are, anywhere in the world. My name is Kat. I'm a member of Pot Mob. I want to start by acknowledging that we are here today on unceded tribal territory. The land that we call Portland is the traditional lands of the Kalapulya, the Northern Malala, the Multnomah, which is a band of the Chinook, the Tualatin, and the Cowlitz, who are over the Columbia River. People from these tribes have been part of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, the Confederated Tribes of Select Indians, and the Chinook tribe up in Washington State. We do this for a reason. We want to acknowledge that Portland is the sixth largest urban Native American population in the country. We want to acknowledge that these people are still here, that our presence here is a disruption to the sovereignty of tribal communities, and that knowing that we need to know this and acknowledge this, and as we move forward as a community doing whatever work it is that I'm doing, that you're doing, that we are doing, that we hold that and center that, and that we engage with and support tribal communities, and that we constantly ask ourselves how we can better center the needs of tribal communities in the work that we are doing. So, Pot Mob came together in response to the dramatic increase in violence witnessed in Portland on June 30th during Patriot Prayer's most recent alt-right rally, second most recent. We are activists and organizers that come from all walks of life. We are parents, we are teachers, artists, union members, healthcare providers, receptionists, food service workers, and students. We care about communities under attack in this current climate, our communities in Portland and beyond. We want a world free from white supremacy, free from racism, free from xenophobia and the criminalization of migration. We want a world free from homophobia, from transphobia, and free from sexism. A world free from ability discrimination, a world free from poverty and lack of access to food and healthcare, lack of access to housing and education. And we believe that these things are possible. And because we believe these things are possible, we feel that it is our responsibility to agitate, to bring that world to be. We are all anti-fascists. We formed our coalition around a single unifying goal, to inspire the people of Oregon, you guys, to show up and resist the alt-right. We know that we far outnumber those who support them, and that we are powerful when we come together. We don't have to import our supporters from all over the country, because Portland takes care of its own. So why are we here right now? So we call this a survivor shout out. We've called for this event to occur 2 hours before Patriot Prayer's alt-right hymn 2 event. You can boo and hiss. Because while we believe in directly confronting these fascists and proto-fascists, white nationalists and misogynists, we realize that on the subject of domestic and sexual violence, that they're not gonna listen to us, right? We're at a pivotal moment in history where a significant portion of this country lacks the desire or even the capacity to question the information being fed to them by the right-wing media ecosystem.
I'm Olivia. I'm with the Democratic Socialists of America. By showing up, you are helping to let the fascists know that they are not welcome here, and that as long as they keep showing up, we keep showing up. Because the only thing that can stop a crowd of fascists is a bigger crowd of anti-fascists. You think that when they are dismissing the voices of survivors and mocking the Me Too movement, we're gonna stay home and eat sheet cake? No. Do you think that when they're flying people in from all over the country to bring Portland back to its ugly white supremacist roots, we should just hand it over to them? No. Don't listen to anyone who tells you that we can ignore the fascists and they'll go away.
All right, we're gonna close out Survivors Are Everywhere with our final speaker. I want you to put your hands together for the co-chair of Portland Jobs with Justice, a black Puerto Rican trans woman who's here today, who is pissed as f- put your hands together for Alyssa.
I love you! Look! Okay! It hurts so bad when there are people who we know that don't like what's going on, that feel like this political moment is hurting their feelings, is putting them in distress, but they don't come out yet. Yet. And it hurts. It feels like we're inadequate, like we're not doing enough, like we're not saying the right thing, like we haven't come up with the right program, that we haven't built enough solidarity up. We need to keep mobilizing. Anti-fascism cannot just be our troops guarding us back here. And thank you. I love y'all. I'm talking to y'all. It can't just be people who are blocked up that are the face of anti-fascism. It needs to be all of us. We need to be able to make pop mob, popular mobilization, popular. That means that when you're on your way here with a contingent passing a bougie coffee shop and the people are looking outside the windows, you know, scared of the socialists coming, you need to train your comrades to be able to, on the drop of a dime, run inside and say, hi, everybody. You know, we're on our way to a rally right now in order to counter the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer. They're doing a rally today so that we question women and survivors of all genders. I'm trans, thank you. Okay, okay, all right, okay, not you, them, you know. I love y'all. So, you know, that what they put forward is that we should question people more about whether or not their sexual assault that they come forward and talk about is real or not. As if that's not the way of the world already. No. It is because women and survivors of all genders are coming forward like they have not before. That are saying, this happened to me. Believe me. And thank God, thank the goddess, it's people like us that are saying, I believe you.
Time is 2 p.m. The Portland police are using a loudspeaker to tell protesters to move away from the Patriot Prayer rally. At one point, the Unipiper showed up and blasted his opposition to Patriot Prayer. The police used their loudspeakers to push the left opposition around town per usual.
This is the Portland Police Bureau. This is a civil disturbance. You must leave the area. Failure to do so may result in force being used against you. Leave now.
I'd like to thank Zale Chadwick for her recording. For KBOO Portland, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Tammy Lynn Stoner, author of the new novel, Sugarland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, you'll hear Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, 51 degrees with no precipitation. Today in history, Willie O'Ree, the first black player to play in the National Hockey League, was recently inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame as a builder, a pioneer player of the sport. The quote of the day is from Audre Lorde, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. British Columbia is taking steps toward cleaning up an old mine polluting salmon-rich rivers. As Jacob Resnick reports, the Tulsiqua Chief Mine has long been a concern for Tlingit tribes in both Canada and Alaska.
The Canadian mine had developed in the early 20th century, but was abandoned in 1957. John Morris Sr. recalls commercial salmon fishing on the Taka River from the 1940s, when people in southeast Alaska began to speculate about the mine upstream impacting the fish.
It was later on, like 1957, I think, that somebody finally said, you know, if you go up to the Tulsiqua Chief Mine, you're going to see that holding pond, and it's real orange, and there's a pipe leading out, and it's leaching right into the river.
Morris is a leader with the Douglas Indian Association, a federally recognized tribe in Juneau that's been working to get the mine site cleaned up for decades. Tlingit elders on the other side of the border have been doing the same.
Nothing has really been done. There was attempts to put in a treatment plant, which sort of went sideways. It didn't work.
John Ward is the elected spokesman for the Taku River Tlingit First Nation in Atlin, B.C. Earlier this month, BC's ministry responsible for mining put a request for proposals for a private contractor to clean up the site. That's welcomed by Ward.
They are making some moves now, so that's good news.
The mine's legacy left mineral sulfides exposed to air and water that's been generating acidic runoff for decades. Elders like John Morris said they've waited this long. They'll keep up the pressure.
We don't want to quit. We want to keep pushing to get this done. You know, I'm 78 years old. That was 61 years ago that mine had been shut down and contaminating the Taku. And that is one of the things that I put on my list to hopefully get done before I'm gone.
Governor Bill Walker had written to his counterpart in B.C. on October 31st, urging the premier to order the full reclamation of the Tulsiqua Chief Mine. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Nanticoke Lenni Lenape Tribal Nation in New Jersey has affirmed its status as a state-recognized tribe, ending litigation. The tribe claimed it lost access to grants, business contracts, and had other losses due to efforts by the state to undermine its recognition. A recently settled lawsuit concedes the state recognized the tribe in 1982 and reaffirmed its official status over the decades. The settlement with the state includes $2.4 million in compensation to the tribe. An auction of Native items from the Medford Public Library in Massachusetts is drawing criticism from Native Americans. The library plans to auction off artifacts acquired in the 1800s, which are Pacific Northwest Indian, described as surplus goods in a public notice. An auction house in Boston is scheduled to put them up on December 1st. The Boston Herald reports the North American Indian Center of Boston is calling the auction unconscionable and is questioning if the library has the legal right to auction off the items. The library declined to comment to the newspaper. A California tribe is donating $1 million to victims of the Camp Fire. The Lytton Rancheria tribe and its casino announced last week it was donating to the Tri-County's Bank Camp Fire Fund. The fund was established recently to help people impacted by the wildfire, which is being called one of the deadliest in California history. The funds will be distributed through local nonprofit groups serving fire victims. Tribal leaders hope the donation can help people recover and rebuild their lives. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwantlen Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
Support by the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism's MA in Social Journalism, Rethinking Journalism as a Community Service. Application deadline is December 14th at journalism.cuny.edu. Support by BNSF Railway Company. BNSF honors the commitment of Armed Forces members and is a top employer for U.S. military veterans, hiring over 9,000 veterans since 2005. More at jobs.bnsf.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The Fuego volcano near the town of Iscuintla in Guatemala began a fierce eruption this week, forcing the evacuation of thousands. The red glow from the top of the 12,000-foot peak could be seen for 100 miles away as lava shot up to 1,600 feet and ashes and smoke blasted a mile into the air. 200 residents in the town who still remained were moved to safe zones by Guatemalan authorities. The volcano is repeating its performance of this past October. It's only 22 miles from a million people living in Guatemala City. Lava is glowing red as it flows down the steep slopes, and residents of Iscuintla are fleeing amid falls of rock and ash. Juan Pablo Oliva, the head of the country's Seismological, Volcanic, and Meteorological Institute, says conditions could become worse. This is the fifth such eruption in the past year for the cone-shaped volcano.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 19th, 2018. Here are the main points again. FBI classifies Proud Boys as an extremist group. The Me Too rally. And, in international news, a major volcanic eruption in Guatemala. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is... Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones, Rachel Hartley, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer and engineer is Rachel Hartley, and the director of Evening News is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH, on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rachel Hartley.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, an alternative radio, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, breaks down the foundational links between white nationalism and gun ownership. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Humankind continues discussing ways to build a healthy diet. And at 11:30, Art Focus talks to Robert Hoffman about architecture diversity and the AIA Awards. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Rachel. Good night, Mike.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Most of us know the song Midnight Special by blues musician Huddy Leadbetter, better known as Leadbelly. It's actually an old tune that Leadbelly learned and made his own, including these lyrics. If you ever go to Houston, boy, you'd better walk right. And you better not squabble, you better not fight. Benson Crocker will arrest you, Jimmy Boone will take you down. You could bet your bottom dollar that you're Sugar Land bound. Those words come directly from Lead Belly's own experience as an inmate in a Sugar Land, Texas penitentiary. In Tammy Lynn Stoner's debut novel, Sugar Land, the main character, Miss Dara, a young woman growing up in a small 1920s Texas town, meets Lead Belly at that penitentiary and discovers there's more than one type of prison. Tammy Lynn's a Portland-based writer born in Midland, Texas. She's lived in 16 cities in three countries, working as a biscuit maker, forklift operator, gas station attendant, and college instructor, among other odd jobs. And her work has appeared in numerous anthologies and literary journals, including The Night, The Rain, and The River, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. We're fortunate to have Tammy Lynn here with us now to talk about Sugar Land. Tammy Lynn Stoner, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tammy Lynn, you've written that Sugar Land has its roots in three short stories you wrote for a Tin House Writers Workshop led by Steve Allman, who along with Cheryl Strait is one of the sugars of Dear Sugars podcast. There's a lot of sugars today. And those stories all centered on Nana Dara, the main character in the new novel.
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about those stories, how the book got started?
Well, I had three stories that were going to be part of a linked collection. So that means you have a bunch of short stories that follow, in this case, the same family. So I was really excited about not getting another novel through my dysfunctional novel pipeline. I'd tried to write a novel before that, and it turned out it went horribly wrong and ruined my life for about 10 years. So I took these stories, hell-bent on making a link collection, and Steve Allman said, you know, you should consider making this into a novel. So when I read the Lead Belly story, I knew that I would have the backbone that would kind of keep me on track if I wanted to try a novel again, and I did, and that's Sugar Land now.
And from what I read, that was a few months after the workshop. You read about Lead Belly and his stay at the Imperial State Prison Farm in Sugar Land, Texas, and it's sometimes referred to as just the Sugar Land Prison or Penitentiary. And you also learned something amazing, certainly to me, that he literally sang his way out of a steep jail sentence.
That's right. Yeah, Lead Belly was, I think at that point was known as Lead Belly, but in the book I changed that a little bit. And I noted a bunch of things at the end of the book. I took some creative license, but with the Lead Belly story itself, I tried really hard to stay as historically accurate as possible. And that's part of the reason why the book took so long to write, is it was a pretty monumental research involved with it. But so what happened was Lead Belly was in prison, and they had given him a 12-string guitar, and he was playing for the other prisoners, the other convicts, and would play around in the fields to sort of make the days a little bit better. And the governor came on Sundays when Lead Belly would play for the guards at the penitentiary, and the governor came and heard him play, and so Lead Belly got an idea that he was going to sing for a pardon. So he did. He sung Goodnight Irene, and the governor and the governor's wife was there. And the governor had actually, Governor Neff had run on a platform of not pardoning criminals.
Because the previous governor he actually sold pardons.
That's right.
He was very corrupt.
So it was very, it was a very staunch part of his platform when he ran for governor. So he did pardon Lead Belly, and he pardoned him on the very last day that he was in office.
Which was a good thing for Lead Belly, because he was in for a 35-year jail sentence for murder.
Yeah, he was in for murder. He came back later to the system again for murder.
And was released again,
and
right?
And was released again.
Based on his musical abilities.
That time, I believe he had tried to sing again for another pardon, but there was a mixture of reasons why. It was also just that they were having to empty out some of the prisons because of financial reasons. But yes, he was definitely born under a charm star, I think. Yeah.
So we started with these stories, the Nana Dara stories that you workshopped at Tin House, and now the story of Lead Belly. How did they both come together?
Well, I shifted all the stories back. The stories were set in the 50s, and I shifted them back, or I shifted one of them notably back to the 1920s, so that I could have my main character, Miss Dara, Nana Dara, meet up with Lead Belly in prison, and then be inspired by him singing his way out for her to then follow suit and leave prison as well. She was there, obviously, voluntarily. It was an all-men's prison, and she was a cook there. So I had to shift things around a little bit, but I did use Lead Belly quite a bit to keep me on track and get me through the trauma of approaching another pretty big novel. This covers like 55 years, I think. So
now the novel begins in 1923, and Miss Dara takes that job in the kitchen of Sugar Land. She meets Lead Belly there, which we mentioned, and the novel takes her through that pre-war years, post-war years, the civil rights movement in the South in the 1960s in the very volatile Vietnam War era years in the U.S. Why did you choose to cover such a wide patch of time? I mean, that's about 60 years right there.
I'm an absolute glutton for punishment. You know, I think part of it is that I really love learning detail about history, about the world, or even in the new novel I'm writing, it happens in the future. So I learn different details about potentialities for ocean climate or medicine. I just really get into research, and it's a huge portion of what inspires me to write. So in this case, it gave me the opportunity to learn about all these different time frames, but also I wanted my character Nana Dar to follow along sort of the gay rights trajectory. So I wanted her to end in 1968, right before the Stonewall riots that kick off the gay rights movement. So I wanted her self-acceptance to sort of follow the line of the social acceptance of gay rights.
Now, you grew up in a small Texas town yourself in Midland, Texas, and that was in the 1960s. And growing up queer in a town like that, it was certainly something you probably hid. It was probably not easy.
Well, I didn't grow up in Midland. I was in Midland for, I think, about 4 or 5 years, and then we moved to Gulfport, Mississippi, and then we made our way up to Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. So it's small town, small town, small town. It's the same
The same difficulties.
Yeah, the same attitude in the small towns. Yeah, it was definitely not dinner time conversation by any stretch of the imagination. It was it was a challenging time, to be sure. But by the time I was really becoming aware of things, it was more in the 80s. So there was, at least in my social group of friends, there was a level of acceptance at that point, even if it wasn't in my family.
Now, Miss Dara, she's 19 years old or so when the book starts, and that's in 1923. And she had fallen in love with a friend of hers and went to work in the prison to kind of escape that.
Right.
How did you apply your own experiences growing up and discovering your sexual orientation with Miss Dara's in the book?
Very similarly, I think. And really one of the main influences for me in writing Dara was my relationship with my partner now, because she had a very difficult time. She was my first girlfriend in college, and I was her first girlfriend. And so she had I was really pretty good with it. I was ready to go. I was ready to do whatever. I was very much like Dara's girlfriend in the book. And my girlfriend, who's now my partner, was not okay with it and really just shut down and ended the relationship and did essentially what happened in the book. So I really am familiar with somebody taking something that's really beautiful and, because of societal pressures, just ending it very dramatically and very cut and dry. So part of it was that, obviously, and part of it was then, you know, you realize you do put yourself in prisons. You back away from letting people know who you are, or are hesitant to be as open with people until you're really comfortable in your own skin, basically.
Yeah, I thought that was a brilliant stroke in the book to compare the actual prison, the Sugarland Penitentiary where Leadbelly was imprisoned, with the imprisonment of somebody who can't really come out and express who they really are due to societal pressures and the possible repercussions.
Yeah, I think somewhere in the book it says that that there always be walls to a prison, and it's just a matter of how far back you push them until you can't see them anymore. And that was this idea that I really wanted to work around, that you're not ever going to be necessarily out of some kind of prison, but if you don't see it or you don't acknowledge it or it doesn't bother you or it doesn't affect you, then it's not there for you emotionally. So when I read the Leadbelly story, it just clicked automatically that could be used in that way.
Yeah, I could see the the connections where Leadbelly actually was able to escape his prison by becoming more of who he was.
That's right.
this great musician, and Miss Dara, later to become Nana Dara in the book, is facing the same situation.
That's absolutely great. You should write all my marketing materials.
So in other words, rather than trying to escape who you are, one way of truly escaping is becoming more
of
who you are.
Like when you step into who you are meant to be and who you're most comfortable being, there are no walls that will bother you. There's nothing that would really keep you from being who you really are. The prison really is not about the walls. It's about what you become inside them. So yeah, as Leadbelly found his way through his music, and that was his love, really his great love, Nana Dara also found her way eventually to being true to who she was.
And we see a lot of that, of course. So you cover the 60 years there. So her life goes from starting as 19 in 1923, to the early 80s when she passes away. So we see her developing quite a bit as a character, and fascinating character. She has a double wide trailer called the Bland Old Opry.
The Bland Old Opry, yeah.
Two stepdaughters. Uh-huh. Should we talk briefly about how she gets out of prison? Would that be giving too much away?
No, I think it's all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
She doesn't sing.
She doesn't sing. No.
And of course, she's not really under a jail sentence, but
that's right.
In a way, she's kind of stuck there in the kitchen in Sugarland.
You know, you didn't have a lot of opportunity necessarily as a woman back in those times, even though there were some progressive movements happening even inside Texas. That would be why I had the warden hire her. That would not have probably happened in real life, but I did want some representation of the fact that there were some progressive movements in Texas. But for her, there weren't a lot of options for her getting out of prison. Once you got in there and that was your job and that's what you chose to do. So the warden asked her to marry him, and she did.
And she acquired two stepdaughters who play a very big, important role in the book.
That's right. So in marrying him, she had an instant family in a sort. And you know, their marriage was much more platonic, probably, and a very kind and gentle and nice marriage. But it certainly wasn't setting any houses on fire. But I think that's what a lot of people did then. A lot of people still do, is they make the best of their situation. And if she couldn't be with Rhody because she chose not to, and had she done it...
And Rhody was her childhood friend.
That's
who
right.
she fell in love with.
Yeah, and I think had they pursued that at the time, it may not have ended that well. So I think that she did the best she could and ended up having a pretty nice life of it in the end.
It's amazing. That's about, what, 1923, so 95 years ago, right? And Texas doesn't seem all that different today.
Yeah,
today. I mean, I don't know if that Beto O'Rourke election is called yet. It looks like Ted Cruz won, but
yeah.
It's still every seat in there is Republican, and it still seems somewhat repressive, at least in terms of the state legislature.
It is a little bit. Obviously, it is part of the South, and the South does not abide change. So it is, although there are pockets. I mean, you know, you look at Austin, for example, where I lived for a couple of years. And
Atlanta and Georgia.
I mean, there are definitely pockets. And there, I find that there's a great tolerance. The issues seem to be less and less around queerness, I think, in the South, than it was before. That may not be true about specific issues. You know, trans rights, these kinds of things are really shining flags all over the place.
Well, that's true even in Portland.
Yeah. So, but in general, if you're just talking about two people holding hands on the street, I think now it's not going to get you stoned. I don't think.
Now, on your website, you list a few of your current projects. There's one called the Cycle of Salt Trilogy, which you describe as taking place in a near future world. I think 2096, something like that. What's that like, going from a story grounded in such historical detail to one where you have a lot more freedom to let your imagination roam?
It's very interesting. And again, I think having the confidence now of producing this work, which again is a little epic-y on scale from the time, but this next one takes place in the future. It only takes place for a year, but it's from four or five different points of view, and it is about restructuring an entirely new world. But it's still based in a lot of science, a lot of fact. So again, that's another one that I spent 5 years researching to make sure that everything would actually be feasible that ends up happening in it. So it's similar.
Well, we look forward to that.
Thank you.
Tammy Lynn, can you tell our listeners where they can find out more information about Sugarland and your other work?
You can go to my website, Tammy, T-A-M-M-Y, Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, stoner.com, and Sugarland's available everywhere right now.
Well, thanks very much for joining us at KBOO.
Thank you so much. What a lovely interview. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. We've been talking with Tammy Lynn Stoner, author of the novel Sugarland from Redhead and Press. You can learn more about Tammy Lynn and her work at tammylynnstoner.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth. Thank you.
We'll be right back. Blacksmith by the Carlo Caetano Trio from their 2013 release, Impromptu. I'm Jay, and we're hammering out another edition of Deep Threes. Sampler artist Bob Ostertag first played the Buchla 200 synthesizer as a 19-year-old music student in 1976. He came back to the updated 200E analog synthesizer in 2011, still complete with patch cord connections, for his Motormouth project. Here's the title track, recorded in one take.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
The time is 6 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Thank you for listening. Joining me in the studio tonight is my good friend Connor Toth. Connor is not only my friend, but also a local Portlander and a low-carbon transportation activist. So today that may give you an indication that we're going to be discussing transportation issues and how that impacts the working class and working people in general. So Connor, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me on today, Michael.
So some big news that really came out just in the last few hours here today is that our friends to the north in Seattle,